Case number 20-1148, USA versus James Warner, oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Gurlwitz for the appellant.
You're on mute, Mr. Gurlwitz. You're on mute.
Thank you. Sure. I'm sorry. Okay, no problem. Let me start again. May it please the court, Harold Gurlwitz on behalf of James Warner. This case presents the issue whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied Mr. Warner's motions for continuance and new trial without carefully inquiring about and weighing retained counsel Robert Harrison's physical health limitations that progressed from the time before trial and trial preparation and conferences throughout the trial. Those conditions included what was diagnosed after trial as a fractured spine. And it included, as Mr. Harrison described in the affidavits he submitted in support of the new trial motion, a loss of static balance, inability to stand to examine witnesses, pain and fatigue during trial. Mr. Warner's Sixth Amendment right to representation by his choice of retained counsel, counsel he had chosen over a year before the trial, was ignored by the court. Safeguarding that right should have required inquiry by the court. According to Justice Scalia in United States v. Gonzalez-Lopez at 548 U.S. 140, the right to counsel of choice contemplates the defendant's personal right to choose counsel for his own counsel's own individual abilities. And according to Justice Scalia, page 150, those include a consideration of counsel's style of witness examination and jury argument, and the strategy that he will bring to bear upon the case, including jury selection and his arguments to the jury.
Mr. Gurlwitz, it's Judge Cole. You know, in looking at the record, is it fair to say that, I know you take issue with Judge Roberts maybe not asking enough questions about Mr. Warner's back problems. But Judge Roberts did engage with the counsel a fair amount in status conferences and prior to trial in terms of Mr. Harrison's requests. Mr. Harrison continued as counsel during the trial. He had co-counsel with Mr. Galea. He had indicated at one point he might seek to retain additional counsel, I think, but never did do that. So Mr. Warner had his counsel of choice in Mr. Harrison, who from the record appears to have engaged fully in the trial. And the judge, district judge, made it pretty clear that she would provide every accommodation she could think of, including half-day trials and physical accommodations, stand-up desk, and things of that nature. So, is there some case that would, is there some case that would support the proposition that Mr. Warner here did not have his choice of counsel, when in fact Mr. Harrison did serve as counsel?
Well, Your Honor, the issue we've raised isn't directly about whether or not Mr. Warner was denied that Sixth Amendment right. What we have argued is that the denial of the motion for continuance and the denial of the motion for new trial was an abuse of discretion by the judge. The judge's duty to inquire was, as I'm explaining, informed by the right to counsel of choice as explained in Gonzalez-Lopez. The judge—
Well, let me just ask, So you think the district judge's duty was to just ask more questions about the nature of the physical ailment, get more medical details?
Now, at bottom, Your Honor, the judge's obligation was to take into consideration Mr. Harrison's condition when she acted upon the requests that were made for a continuance and when she denied the motion for new trial.
But didn't she do that?
No,
the accommodations, the half days. I'm not sure why Mr. Harrison didn't ultimately agree to the half days. And at some point there was going to be a week in between trial? I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time asking these questions, but I'm just trying to make sure I understand.
The judge made two decisions before trial, one in response to the email request that was sent by Mr. Harrison on May 6, 15, and then in response to the motion for new trial, which addressed his physical health conditions in more detail. His request for an additional counsel was made because of his health condition. The answers, which is the important part for the continuance consideration, the answers by the judge in each of these and her denial of the motion, ECF 110, failed to take into consideration his health condition at that time. And certainly, after the judge had the benefit—
Berwitz, excuse me for interrupting you, but ordinarily when a criminal defendant appeals, he's appealing about something that adversely affected him. You're not saying that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. So what's the adverse, sounds to me like the impact on Mr. Harrison may have been considerably adverse if he was in pain, but how, it's hard for me to see how your client suffered.
Well, Your Honor, he suffered because the judge denied the motion for continuance to allow Mr. Harrison the opportunity to either obtain counsel or to obtain relief from his condition, for which he obtained surgery at the Mayo Clinic in September over a period of three days.
The attorney is not the appellant.
No, he's not. The appellant, though, complains that what he was denied was a continuance so that he could have the counsel he had chosen the year before trial as the one representing him at the trial.
Judge Seiler.
I was going to say, Chief Judge Cole mentioned the fact that the court offered to allow these just to be half days and then have a kind of a recess in between. Did Mr. Harrison just turn that down and say that wouldn't work, or did the defendant turn it down, or what happened?
Your Honor, Mr. Harrison was certainly the individual who was most informed about and aware of his physical health conditions. He agreed with the schedule which was put forth, which turned out to be a mix of full and half days, mostly partial days. The problem wasn't the timing. The problem wasn't the accommodations offered by the court. The problem was the fatigue, the inability to stand, the inability to connect with the jurors and the witnesses that were the byproduct of this. And it fits exactly within the definition in Unger versus Serafi, the Supreme Court decision on continuance from 1964, which says that a myopic insistence upon expeditiousness in the face of justifiable request for delay can render the right to defend with counsel an empty formality. The judge's decisions on her motion, on Mr. Harrison's motion to continue, and his motion for new trial, make no reference to any of the information, particularly Mr. Harrison's letter from his doctor 5 days after the trial ended that said that he was in no condition to conduct any trial at that time, or his affidavit, which explained his diagnosis at the Mayo Clinic and probably explained that it was a fractured spine that was causing him this discomfort during trial.
Was his problem too, mostly that he couldn't think straight, or he couldn't move around in the courtroom and go up to a witness or speak in front of the jury?
What Justice Scalia said is an essential element of the right to counsel of choice is the counsel who and a defendant and a private person picks as someone who's not a participant in the criminal justice system, to be able to argue to the jury, to be able to select the jury, to be able to ask questions. And when that right isn't as it was represented by Mr. Harrison's condition before the trial, then I think it was up to the judge to take those factors into consideration.
I've had cases when I was a district judge where we had attorneys who were in wheelchairs and attorneys who couldn't walk, and they did quite well. It's no problem for that, is it?
No, not at all, Your Honor. It's not the inability, perhaps, to stand, but the inability to stand because of pain and fatigue that was caused by a broken back that I'm complaining about, that we're asking for relief from. Yeah, with regard to these issues one and two. Let me just then, if I can, and I can't see, I don't have the gallery view up here, the amount of time I have.
You have a minute and 15 seconds.
But let me just briefly then address the constructive amendment issue, which is something that is very peculiar in the circumstances of this case. It is that the only instruction telling the jury what the charges were told them that the object bribery offense in three of the conspiracy charges was different than that alleged in the indictment. The instructions, it was repeated three times in instruction 15. It was not corrected by an instruction on the elements of the offense, which really only dealt with the particular charge in count 9. And the jury, although given the indictment, was not able to figure it out from the indictment. For example, count 7, which only alleged a conspiracy to commit bribery, did as what happened in the Combs case, intermingled the language of the bribor statute with the statutory reference to the bribery statute. Your Honor, this is per se prejudice. Mr. Warner's substantial rights were affected by the instructions that were given to the jury, including the mistakes in the indictment.
Okay, thank you. You will have your 4 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Hurley?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Dan Hurley, and I represent the United States. I think the problem that Mr. Gerwitz runs into is that the information that he wants to rely most heavily on is the affidavit and the medical information presented post-trial. And he wants to use that to challenge the decision of Judge Roberts pre-trial. If Mr. Harrison had said to Judge Roberts, "Here's the note from my doctor, I can't think straight because I'm in so much pain," that we don't have any argument with the idea that, of course, Judge Roberts should have gotten more information. And if Mr. Harrison had at any point said to Judge Roberts, "I can't do this," then of course the trial judge at least has to look further into it, if not grant an adjournment. But he never said that. When you look at the record closely, you realize that what Mr. Harrison presented to Judge Roberts was he first told her, "I have back trouble." But in April, he said, "I've got 4 jury trials scheduled back to back to back to back." And then the week before trial, he sends an email and he says, "My back's hurting me, but I'm not asking for an adjournment. I just want some accommodation in terms of being able to sit or stand as necessary, take a break now and then." And the district court, of course, had no problem with that. When the case manager said, "You know, we might have to go some full days if counsel is correct in their projection of how long, how many hours of trial this is going to take, we might need full days." Turned out they were wrong. They didn't need the full days in any event. But at that point, Mr. Harrison, again, did not say, "I can't do this trial. I can't do anything." What he said in his email at shortly before 6 o'clock on the Thursday before a trial was, "I can't do a significant number of full days. I can do Fridays. I can do some. I can't do a significant number," is what he said. At that point, he also did say, "If you adjourn, then I'll look into getting another lawyer." Not because I can't represent my client effectively, not because I can't do this trial. He said he'd look into getting a new lawyer so that the court's scheduling wouldn't be affected, so the court could schedule as many full days as it needed. That is the only reference to there ever being another lawyer on this case. Judge Roberts said, "If there's something you want to ask of the court, then you should do what lawyers do. You should file a motion." And when he filed the motion, at no point did he say, "I can't think straight. My memory is affected. I can't do this trial, Judge. Please don't make me do it." What he said was, "I want to make sure there's enough time for all of our evidence. I don't want my client's full trial to be truncated. And I don't want to have to go some unspecified number of full days." In response, Judge Roberts said, "Of course, I'm not going to cut off your client's ability to put on a defense or to have the government put on its case. And the judge proposed several schedules. I think Judge Cole, you pointed out, the judge offered a schedule of nothing but half days, which was 100% consistent with everything that Mr. Harrison had set up to that point. And as Judge Roberts reflected in her subsequent orders, they rejected that. And they said, we're going to stick with the original schedule. On that record, I don't see how it can be an abuse of discretion for Judge Roberts to say, well, then we're going to go with the trial. I gave you options. I met everything you said. And you said, let's go with this trial. So they began trial. It was an extremely relaxed trial schedule. They were almost all half days. There were significant breaks, 2 days on, 2 days off, 4 days on, 4 days off. At the end of the first week, on the Friday afternoon, Judge Roberts said, Mr. Harrison, is there anything you want to say to me? Is there anything you want to bring to my attention? And he didn't say, Judge, I can't do this. Judge, I'm compromised in my ability. What he said was, it's nice to see you this week, Your Honor. They get to the next week. At no point does Mr. Harrison say, I can't do this. If Mr. Harrison was compromised in his ability to move around the courtroom, I don't think that's of constitutional dimension. If he was compromised in his ability to think straight, to remember salient details or things of that sort, well, obviously that is of greater concern, but nothing in this record says that. If Mr. Harrison was aware of that was going on, he had an ethical obligation to bring that to the court's attention, and he didn't. And he also had another lawyer who knows Mr. Harrison well. He's an associate with him. He knew the case. He knows Mr. Harrison. And that lawyer also had both the Sixth Amendment and an ethical obligation to alert the court if there was any impairment or limitation on Mr. Harrison's ability to try the case in terms of his mental fitness. That lawyer said nothing. In his brief, Mr. Gerwitz says that there were 4 points in the record that show that there was some effect on Mr. Harrison. But when you look at them, they don't actually withstand scrutiny. The first one he points to is simply the occasion when the standing desk, essentially, that Judge Roberts obtained in an effort to meet Mr. Harrison's request for accommodation. It's just the point in the transcript when that arrives and they take a break to bring it in and move things around. Another is a point where Mr. Harrison says, is it okay if I sit down? And the judge says, of course, it's okay if you sit down. And they rearrange things so that Mr. Harrison would have direct view with the witness, be able to see the jury, et cetera. The third one is when Mr. Harrison again said, I'm having trouble with my balance. Can I sit down? The judge said, take your time. I have no problem with you sitting down. And they took a short break. And they didn't resume until Mr. Harrison said to Judge Roberts, I'm ready to go. I can't for the life of me understand how that reflects Judge Roberts failing the defendant under these circumstances. The only time that there was any reference to Mr. Harrison not wanting to or not being able to proceed was the very last occasion that was right before or during his direct examination of his client. It was on the last full day of testimony. And at that point, Mr. Harrison said, you know, if we're up to me, I'd probably ask for a break. I'd ask for an adjournment of some sort. But my client wants me to proceed. And Judge Roberts turned to Mr. Warner and said, is that true? You heard what your lawyer said. Do you want him to proceed, notwithstanding what he's just told us? And Mr. Warner said, yes, I want to proceed with the case. If Judge Roberts had said, no, I insist on a break, then we'd be here on the opposite side of this issue. This is, frankly, a little bit of revisionist history going on. We're mixing and matching the physical impairment of he can't walk, he can't move, his balance with is he mentally impaired in a way or to a degree that it affects his ability to provide adequate representation? And there's just nothing in this record that substantiates that in any way, shape, or form. Judge Roberts, when she was told, I have these issues, she said, file a motion. That's how lawyers communicate with judges. I have never heard of a case where a court of appeals has said when the judge invites briefing, the judge also has an obligation to then ask the lawyers personally, is there anything else you want to tell me that you didn't put in your brief? Are there any exhibits? Is there anything else you want to put in the record that you didn't put in your motion or didn't attach to your brief? She said, tell me what I need to know. File a brief. They filed the brief. It didn't include any of the information that we're now trying to throw into the record to make it look like Judge Roberts abused her discretion. On this record, there's simply no basis to conclude Judge Roberts abused her discretion. There's nothing to suggest that Mr. Warner himself had any interest in any other lawyer representing him. If anything, the record suggests the opposite. When Mr. Harrison suggested it the night before in the email exchange, and the judge said, well, go ahead and file a motion if you're going to go down that road, there wasn't a word about it. And I think it's a reasonable inference that Mr. Warner either didn't want to pay for it because these are retained counsel we're talking about, and he already had two lawyers that he was paying for, or it was going to entail a significant time delay, because it wasn't as if Mr. Harrison said, I've got another lawyer lined up, he's ready to go, or she's ready to go. There wasn't even a lawyer identified. And so it's from Judge Roberts' perspective, no one's asking for a new lawyer. He just said, I'll get a new lawyer. If you need to go full days, I'll get a new lawyer so that my inability to go all these full days isn't a scheduling problem. And he specifically said, I'll get a new lawyer in the context of the court's ability to make scheduling decisions if she granted an adjournment. That is not an invocation of the right to have counsel of choice. There was no one else. Mr. Harrison was Mr. Warner's choice of counsel, and that's who represented him from start to finish. With respect to the jury instruction issue, unless the court has any questions about the adjournment, I'd like to move to that briefly. There's a couple problems with this argument. Mr. Gurwitz says that it's per se prejudicial. This is plain error. This was not objected to in the district court. And so he has to show error that is plain. When we're talking about jury instructions, we have to consider the instructions as a whole. And that means we look not just at the few stray sentences that are in the introductory sentence of this section. We look at what were the elements that the jury was given. Were they given the right standard in terms of reasonable doubt standard? And were they told the right elements? What were they told they needed to find to conclude the defendant was guilty? And Mr. Gurwitz has not raised any objection to that. The district court's instructions, both as to the 371 offense and as to the object offenses, including the 666A1B, which were set out at instructions 25 and 26, those were completely accurate instructions of the law. So the jury was told, you cannot find Mr. Warner guilty unless you conclude unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt that each of the elements of 666A1B were met, that the government's evidence established those elements beyond a reasonable doubt. In that circumstance, the fact that a few pages earlier, when the court wasn't prescribing elements, the court wasn't telling them what standard to apply, that's just an introductory sentence and it doesn't have any real significance here. The court did similar things with each of these groupings of elements. There was this group for the conspiracy counts. There was the group of the substantive program theft counts. There was a group of the money laundering conspiracy counts. And this is just an introductory instruction to kind of orient the jury. Here's what we're talking about. We're talking about this group of offenses. And then the court in very elaborate detail said, here's exactly what you need to find. So considering these instructions on a whole, particularly on plain error review, there simply wasn't error. In terms of the constructive amendment, there certainly wasn't any variance of proofs. As we said in our brief, these two offenses in the context of a 371, these are two sides of the same coin. The idea that we would have a new trial because there was this passing reference to the contractor giving the money to Mr. Warner, to Mr. Warner, instead of Mr. Warner getting the money from the contractor. That's what this is all about. The difference between 666A1B and 666A2 in this context is, does the contractor give the money to Warner, or does Warner get the money from the contractor?
What was the procedure that the U.S. attorney was trying to promote, that the defendant solicited it, or he just got the bribery?
The evidence was that he both solicited, demanded it, and got it. And we know that a number of ways with respect to each of the three conspiracies that were alleged. Start with the fact that Mr. Warner admitted paying the money. Mr. Warner, in his testimony in this part of the defense case, and in his interview with the FBI agents that the jury heard about, admitted that he got money from each of these contractors. He got an enormous amount from Petula. He admitted he got somewhere in the neighborhood of $113,000 from Mr. Earls. He admitted he got a significant amount of money from Mr. Tenaglia. He also was heard on tape talking with Tenaglia when they were setting up the West Bloomfield scheme that was charged in count 9. They were talking about, how much did you pay me when we were at the airport? What'd you give me then? You gave me about 10%? Because Tenaglia said, I can't pay you that $10,000 a month business that I was paying you. And Warner said, well, this isn't that lucrative. So you were giving me 10%. So there's absolutely no wiggle room in terms of, did the jury properly conclude that the money went from a contractor to Mr. Warner? Did Mr. Warner receive it from a contractor? The evidence was overwhelming, and there really wasn't a dispute about that. I see that my time is up. Unless the panel has any questions, we're prepared to rest on our brief.
Apparently, though, that's it for questions. Mr. Gerwitz?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. There is some misdirection in Mr. Hurley's argument about what the new trial and continuance motions concern. These are not claims in some fashion about Mr. Harrison's performance at trial. The first question is what Mr. Harrison said to the judge. First, in his email dated May 16, 2019, he said, I believe Mr. Warner's right to a full and fair trial will be taken away from him if counsel is impeded by health issues. I will provide a doctor's letter, is what he said, and the judge didn't provide time or an opportunity for him to do that. On May 17th, in his motion, the judge responded to the same day, Mr. Harrison said, it's likely that my performance would be diminished to the point that it would substantially impair Mr. Warner's defense. The next aspect of the consideration under the issue of continuance and new trial denials is what the judge said in response. It isn't just her inquiry and what kind of colloquy she had with Mr. Harrison during the trial. It's what she said in her orders and her email. This court speaks through what it puts into writing. There is no consideration given to Mr. Harrison's health condition in any of those, and that is about which we complain. The Munoz case from this circuit at 605 Fed Third, 359, is one in which there was a complaint that a new trial by the government, that a new trial should not have been granted based upon counsel's ineffective assistance, because he wasn't. And the court agreed. That case discusses the standard to be considered, but it is diverges from what we have here, and ultimately, because there the court was concerned with whether or not counsel was ineffective. This case at bottom concerns whether or not the right to counsel of choice is one that informs the court's obligation to both inquire to the extent necessary and take that information the court should obtain into consideration in deciding the motion for new trial. The court had plenty of information. It wasn't just in hindsight. It was information which informed what was going on with Mr. Harrison during the trial that wasn't explained to him at that time, that he had a broken back.
But you're not claiming ineffective assistance of counsel, are you?
I'm not making that argument. No, Your Honor. This is about what the judge didn't do. The constructive amendment argument really starts off with instruction 15, which is really the only place that the jury got any definition of what these charges were. In each one, it repeats in three separate paragraphs that bribery is to corruptly give, offer, and agree by the person, Pertula, Tenaglia, or Earls. That's not what the indictment charged in any one of those counts. Count five charged both giving and receiving, and the jury never got any instruction on giving, although it was charged in count five, it was completely omitted. Your Honor, it is our position that these instructions left it to the jury to attempt to interpolate from reading instruction 26, which deals with the facts of a different count, count nine, that alleged a substantive bribery relating to the township of West Bloomfield that had nothing to do with these conspiracy charges. And it left them in the dark. And that's not what is supposed to happen with jury instructions. The instruction was a constructive amendment. It was an impermissible amendment, and it affected Mr. Warner's substantial rights. For that reason, I would ask the court to reverse on each of those counts, and as part of the remedy, to also reverse on the money laundering conspiracy charges, which relied upon proof of those bribery and federal program bribery and theft counts for proof of proceeds. Thank you for letting me go over a couple minutes, a couple seconds.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Gurwitz and Mr. Hurley. Certainly appreciate your arguments this afternoon. We'll take the case under submission.